Let me invite you to open up your Bibles to Matthew chapter 28, and we'll begin looking there in just a moment. It is good to see each one of you, our members, and to our visitors. We're thankful especially for your presence. I appreciate the expressions of concern over the last week, those that were tenderly expressed and those that were comically expressed. Your laughter at my pain is actually my love language, so that does not offend me in the least. It is healing very well, incidentally. I want to continue and conclude a series of lessons this morning that we've been looking at for quite some time, looking at Jesus, looking at his life here, looking at various events in his life, instruction, teaching in his life, things that we can learn from him. We've looked at the crucifixion a couple of months back, and then more recently looked at the words leading up to and on the cross. I want to conclude by looking at the idea of the resurrection of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 28, as we see depicted at the end of this and all of the Gospels, the resurrection. Matthew chapter 28, and there in verse 6, it says there that the angels are saying to the women, "He is not here, for he is risen. Just as he said, come and see the place where he is lying. He's risen, the place where he was lying is now empty." I want to think today, both this morning and this evening, as we'll be looking at two lessons about the resurrection, I want to give some particular attention to that event. I think it's easy for us to read past the accounts of the resurrection. They're very familiar to us. And so because of their familiarity, maybe we don't quite appreciate the impact, how important the resurrection was at the time that it happened, how important it still is today. I think another thing that happens as we're reading through, maybe one of the reasons that we read past it is that the Gospels don't really go into detail as far as the implications of the resurrection. They just simply tell us about it. Here's what happened. And it's not till we get to the epistles, till Paul and other writers begin to spend time sort of developing, because of the resurrection, here's what we know to be true. Here's what we believe. And so we get brief accounts. Mark, for instance, gives us very little information about what happened after the resurrection, you know, the proofs of the resurrection. We get some more in the other Gospels, but I think at some level, we're sort of left like the apostles looking at the resurrection. Maybe we have more questions. Over in John chapter 21, and in verse 12, there is, as Jesus is sitting down with the disciples after he's called them in from their fishing, he said to them, come and have breakfast. And then it says, none of the disciples ventured to question him, who are you? Knowing that it was the Lord. That interaction right there, the idea of ventured is the idea of having enough courage. Over in Luke chapter 20 and verse 40, it's talking about those who were questioning Jesus and their courage failed them. They didn't have the courage to ask him any more questions. And so that's the idea here, is that they're just afraid to ask any questions. And one of the reasons is they know it's him. And one commentator, as he's looking at this, it's like, you know it's him, but I mean, there's still some questions because this is the guy that you saw crucified. And so there's so much about the nature of his body, about what this means, and the Gospels simply do not go into all of that. And even after we continue on looking at the accounts of the epistles, we're still perhaps left with some questions. Well, then we come to the epistles, and we do have more development of the doctrines that surround the resurrection, the implications. Carrie read one of those from 1 Corinthians chapter 15, maybe the most thorough explanation of the resurrection and its implications. we're given that much fuller treatment. But as we look at those meanings, sometimes we're studying 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and as we're studying that, we sort of forget the details of the resurrection itself, that it was an actual event. It has some very particular details, and if we don't get those details firmly in our minds as we're looking at the implications of the resurrection, we might forget some of those details, and a lot of people have. As people comment on what the resurrection is and what it's about, they sort of lose sight of the very tangible nature of the resurrection. In fact, some people have gone so far in looking at the implications of the resurrection that they would actually suggest the resurrection was just metaphorical, that it didn't really happen. Well, of course, there's some ridiculousness there, because you don't get to keep the implications of the resurrection if you don't keep the actual resurrection. And of course, that's one of the things that Paul is saying there in 1 Corinthians 15. As I was going through and giving attention to the resurrection over the last several months in preparing these lessons, I found that my faith in the historicity, the factualness of the resurrection was increased, but also my appreciation for the absolute necessity of the resurrection and everything that we believe about our relationship to God. If the resurrection, as Paul says, if the resurrection isn't true, well, then it all just falls apart. And so it has that vital role. I wish I had more time and could just tell you about all the things that I've been looking over, but I think some of it might be boring, but more importantly, some of it might detract from the focus that I want to keep as we're looking at the resurrection. So I've tried to boil things down to focus on a few key elements. Much more material, I promise you, is lying on the cutting room floor than will be included in these two lessons. And so if you feel like I'm chasing a few rabbits, well, just know that I wanted to chase more. And so I'm chasing fewer than I would have liked. But I hope that they're all pertinent. I hope they're all important as we try to piece together some things that I think are important for us to know and to think about the resurrection of Jesus. Well, I want to begin by talking about the facts, about talking about what exactly happened and sort of firmly setting those into our minds. And what we want to do is hold on to those so that no matter what we look at as far as implications, we don't lose sight of these are the facts. As we look at the gospel accounts particularly, they're the ones that sort of lay out the facts for the most part. We get some elements of that over in the epistles, but for the most part, it's the gospel accounts that we rely on, and particularly Matthew, Luke, and John, because they give us the most extended picture of what happens at and after the resurrection. And so as we look at those accounts, there's a few elements that I think we need to put in place. The reason I think we need to hang on to those elements is because there are other things that would make us sort of let go of those. We'll talk about the spiritual nature of the resurrection. We might talk about Jesus walking through walls and just appearing before his disciples. And so that may make us set down some element of the resurrection, some element of the physical nature of the resurrection that I think is vital, that I think is so important. So here's what happened. In the first place, it's important to understand that Jesus died. His soul departed to somewhere. We're not going to get to that just yet, but it went to somewhere. And then his body and his soul were reunited. In John chapter 19, and in verse 30, we see that separation of body and spirit. John 19, and there in verse 30, it says, therefore, when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head and he gave up his spirit. So at that point, the body is there, but the spirit is not. All right. And so there's a separation of soul and body. Where did the spirit go? Well, of course, we have over in Luke chapter 23 and in verse 43. Here in his conversation with the thief, the penitent thief on the cross who is next to him, who asked him, remember me when you come into your kingdom. He said to him, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. Now, we're not going to define paradise this morning. We don't have near enough time to do that this morning and this evening. But it's simply to say it's somewhere else than here. Right? He certainly doesn't mean today you will be with me right here where we are right now. You know, it's somewhere else. We're going to paradise. It's a better place that we're going to. Maybe you could find some help in defining that in places like Luke chapter 16. There seems to be that paradise torture element there with Lazarus and the rich man. But the main point is that his soul and his body are separated. And then, of course, that the body and the soul are reunited in the resurrection. And it's important that we understand that it is the body, that Jesus's body is the thing that was resurrected. The tomb is empty, right? So it's not that Jesus, he is reformed in some way that is visible, but not tangible. Rather, it is the same body that went into the grave is the body that came out of the grave. The empty tomb is reported to us over in Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28. And there, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now after the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to look at the grave. And behold, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone and sat upon it. And his appearance was like lightning, and his clothing as white as snow. The guards shook for fear of him and became like dead men. The angel said to the woman, 'Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who has been crucified. He is not here, for he has risen. Just as he said, come and see the place where he is lying. Go and quickly tell the disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him. Behold, I have told you.'" And so when they don't just report that he has risen, they say, come in and see, there was a body here, it's not there now. And the implication, of course, is that's the body that he is walking around in right now. Luke chapter 24 and verses 1 through 9, Luke 24 and verse 1 through 9, "But on the first day of the week at early dawn, they came to the tomb, bringing the spices which they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men suddenly stood near them in dazzling clothing. And as the women were terrified and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, 'Why do you seek the living one among the dead? He is not here, but he is risen. Remember how he spoke to you while he was still in Galilee, saying that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again.' And they remembered his words. And they returned from the tomb and reported all these things to the 11 and to all the rest." So, again, the empty tomb is a critical aspect of the story. I think about this from the standpoint of when we talk about death, the death of our loved ones, when we're laying a body to rest, as we often say. And sometimes people, I think, well-meaning effort will say something like, "That's not my loved one. He's gone somewhere else. That's just a body." Well, I understand. I understand what they mean by that. And I think that there is an element of truth to that. We talked about the body and the soul being separated. But understand that when the women came, the angel is the one who referred to Jesus in this term. Why do you seek him? He's not here. In other words, indicating that if his body was here, that's still a part of his identity. And when we talk about the resurrection, our bodies are still part of that, right? It's not like you just cast it off and say, "Well, no, we don't need that anymore." No, we're going to need that again. Now, does that mean, there's all sorts of implications there. What about the damages to the body and so forth? Interesting, Jesus still has some of those when he's raised, but I think those are identifying markers. But nevertheless, I think that there still needs to be an appreciation that the bodies that we are walking around in, they do have something to do with the resurrection. And there is an appropriateness to talk about he or she as we are looking at the body of a loved one. That is part of their identity. And it will be, in some way, continuing to be a part of their identity in the resurrection. Well, in addition to the tomb being found empty, as attested by these first witnesses and then the additional witnesses and the apostles who came and also found the tomb empty. We also find that the enemies of Jesus attested to the emptiness of the tomb. In Matthew chapter 28, and verse 11, it says, "Now while they were on their way, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. And when they had assembled together, assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers and said, 'You are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this should come to the governor's ear, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble.' And they took the money and did as they had been instructed. And this story was widely spread among the Jews as it is this day." Now, what that is a certain definite admission on the part of Jesus' enemies that the tomb is certainly empty. Because the much easier thing than paying the soldiers to go and spread a false report would have been to say, "Hey everybody, let's just go look at the tomb." Right? If the body's still there, that's a lot easier than this path. So by paying the soldiers and by taking this path, what they're saying is, yes, indeed, the tomb is empty. And we know it's empty, and we better come up with an explanation for why it's empty. Incidentally, there was a proclamation, I think it would have been about 15 to 20 years later, that this report made it all the way to Caesar. And so I think it would have been a report from Nero or a law from Nero. And a tablet was discovered some years ago. And it's a tablet that was discovered in Nazareth that said, that was a proclamation from Caesar saying that there would be a death penalty for anyone who was stealing bodies out of Jewish tombs. Now, where on earth would a law like that come from? It's very specific. And it's very located in that it's in Nazareth that he's proclaiming this. And in fact, grave robbers were not generally guilty of stealing bodies. They stole treasures. And of course, most people, certainly most believers who are looking at that saying, "Well, I got an idea as to why he might have made a law like that right about that time." And so not only do these enemies spread this story, but it seems that story reaches on up to Caesar, and Caesar, who perhaps is not only taking in that story, but all the implications of the resurrection, passes a law and says, "We'll have none of that," and institutes the death penalty for what the Jews say have just happened. Well, not only was the tomb found empty, but also Jesus appeared to many. The most comprehensive report of that, we could go to the various gospels, but the most comprehensive report is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now, incidentally, it's not comprehensive. It's just more comprehensive than any other single place. I say it's not comprehensive because it doesn't include the first witnesses, right? Paul here is not just reporting the story as it happened. What he's reporting is the convincing elements of the story. And I'll get back to what I mean by that just a little bit later in the lesson. But the idea is that Paul is saying, here are the witnesses that you can go and question, right? So in beginning in verse 3, he says, "I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas and then the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep." And that idea right there, that most of whom remain until now, is the idea of you can go talk to them, right? I think that's the whole point here. As he's building the case and he's talking about the importance of the resurrection, he says, look, not only was he raised, but here's how many people saw him at once, and you can go talk to him right now. If the resurrection was going to be denied, the pattern is laid out by the very people who are advocating the resurrection. Here's how you can go and tear down my story if you like. You can go look at the tomb. You can go question the people. They're still out there. I'm not hiding anything. I'm not saying I'm the only one who saw the golden plates. I'm not relying on witnesses who have all recanted their testimonies. I'm saying it's still out there. And so he points out those 500 witnesses. And then, of course, he says he appeared to James and then again to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to me also. For I am least of the apostles and not fit to be called an apostle because I persecuted the church of God. So he points out all these appearances. And I think that understanding the relationship between the empty tomb and the appearances is very helpful, because what people try to do is explain away one and then they try to explain away the other. But putting them together makes it very difficult to explain away both simultaneously. So, for instance, people will say that what people have is a delusion at this point. Well, having 500 people all see the same delusion at the same time is a pretty difficult thing. But additionally, just putting together the thought of the empty tomb and the appearances, one of those can be explained away. So, for instance, if they came and all they saw was the empty tomb, but they never saw an appearance of Jesus, well, we might come up with a number of explanations for that. One of them being the Jews' explanation. Somebody came and stole the body. In fact, that's even what his followers thought when they got there. Where are they taking him? Right? That's the question that they ask. I want to know where the body is. So that's there. That's even the followers' first assumption, is that somebody's come and taken the body. If all that ever happened was that Jesus was seen somewhere, but there's still a body in the tomb, well, then that could be explained away. There's lots of people who today say that they saw a loved one, right? They saw a premonition. They saw a vision. Usually it's not nearly so tangible as the one that we're going to see here, but they saw that. We might say any number of things. We might say that person, in a desperation to see their loved one, saw them. We might say that they lacked sleep. We might say that they saw someone who looked like their loved one. Any number of explanations, you see. But when we put the two together, it's like one fella said, he was commenting on this, and he said, you know, if I was walking around, he's from London, he said, if I was walking and I saw an elephant going down the street in front of the Houses of Parliament, well, I might come up with a number of explanations. For instance, that I didn't get enough sleep last night. But if I then went home and read a story that an elephant had that day escaped from the Hyde Park Zoo, well, then I would say, oh, and now the most reasonable and rational explanation would be, that's the elephant I saw. And so you see this vision of Jesus, and that alone you might say, well, now maybe I'm the one who's gone bonkers here. But then these reports come in of the empty tomb. Oh, now it means something more. And so we put those two things together, and a rational explanation of those two things is that indeed Jesus rose from the dead. But we press further. It's not just that they saw him, but that they touched him, that they could hold on to him, that he could carry things and do things and have interaction with the physical world around him. In Matthew chapter 28 and in verse 9, it says there, and behold, Jesus met them and greeted them, and they came up and took hold of his feet and worshiped him. When people say that they have seen a loved one, this is not what they are describing. They're not talking about they went up and grabbed hold of their feet, that they wrapped their arms around them. It is visual and, in fact, usually blurry at that. But the notion that they could come near and have this kind of intimate interaction is unprecedented. In Luke chapter 24 and in verse 39, Luke chapter 24 and in verse 39, here, as Jesus appears now to more than just Simon, it says, while he was telling these things, this is verse 36, he stood in their midst and said, peace be to you. But they were startled and frightened and thought that they were seeing a spirit. And he said to them, why are you troubled? And why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see. For a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. That's a very distinctive statement. He's not just saying that I have some sort of substance. I have the appearance of substance, that I have, that I've solidified myself enough so that you can actually interact with me, even though I'm in the spirit realm. He says, I have flesh and bones. And so you can touch flesh and bones. And he invites Thomas, of course, to even stick his fingers into the places of the wounds. It is that body that has been resurrected, and it is that body that has been filled with the life that it once had. In John chapter 20, John chapter 20, and in verse 16, again, Jesus being embraced by Mary, and he said to her, Mary, she turned and said to him in Hebrew, Rabboni, which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, stop clinging to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and your Father and my God and your God. So here she is, grasping hold of him, and it seems will not let go. And he has to tell her to let go of him. Again, just very detailed, very clear, nothing metaphorical about that. Jesus is real and tangible and present. Another element that goes along with that is this interesting account, and it seems very purposeful account, in Luke chapter 24. That Jesus not only was such that he could be touched and held, but that he also is consuming food. And it seems like he does that, to make the very point. Here I am eating. In Luke 24 and verse 41, he says, while they still could not believe it because of their joy and amazement, he said to them, have you anything to eat? And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and he ate it before them. Now notice the connection there, beginning there in verse 41. They still could not believe it, and because of their joy and amazement, they're having a trouble sort of processing this. And it seems like a weird thing on the heels of that, like they just can't believe it. And Jesus says, do you have anything to eat? Why would you do that? I don't think it's just because he's hungry. I think it's a way for Jesus to say, let me show you. I'm here. I'm going to sit down and actually have a meal with you. I'm going to pick up the food that you put down on the table. I'm going to eat it, and it's going to go away. It's not an imagined encounter. And so he presses all of those elements to show them how real his body is that is before them. Now, we need to reconcile that with a couple of other passages. Going back over to 1 Corinthians chapter 15 rather. And remember that I told you that some people will begin to focus on the elements in the epistles, and they'll lose track of the elements that were reported back in the gospel accounts. So for instance, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and beginning in verse 42, it says, so also is the resurrection of the dead. It is sown a perishable body. It is raised an imperishable body. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown, and here's the particular concern, it is sown a natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. So it is also written, the first man, Adam, became a living soul. The last man, Adam, a life-giving spirit. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural. Then the spiritual. The first man came from the earth, earthy. The second man is from heaven. As is the earthy, so also are those who are earthy. And it is, and as is the heavenly, so also are those who are heavenly. Just as we have borne the image of the earthy, we will also bear the image of the heavenly. Now, I say this, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For this perishable must put on the imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. Well, what people will do is they'll come here and they'll say, see, it's a spiritual thing, right? So it's not physical anymore. There's nothing physical about it. And so it's just a spiritual resurrection. And then some people will go so far as to kind of push that back onto the resurrection of Jesus and say, see, it was not a tangible body. It was a spiritual body. Well, I agree it was a spiritual body, but just not in the way that they think. I mean, what they're thinking is a spiritual body really is what we would say is no body at all. And that what happens after the resurrection is your soul continues to exist, and that's what the resurrection is talking about, but there's no real bodily resurrection. Well, just to add one more element to this, John connects our resurrection to his resurrection. Paul does as well in 1 Corinthians 14, but I think John does so even more pointedly when he says, "Beloved, we are now we are children of God." This is 1 John 3 and verse 2. "And it has not appeared as yet what we will be. We know that when he appears, we will be like him because we will see him just as he is." So we don't know. We know exactly what that's going to be like. And I go back to the question of his disciples in John 19 when they're looking at him and they're seeing, you know, they're seeing him there, but they still got questions. There's a change in the resurrected body of Jesus. There is an incorruptibleness to the resurrected body of Jesus. But it is still the body of Jesus. And I think even in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, as he's going through, he's making the connection to the actual body. And he's using that idea of seeds. We read through there. It's sown this way. It is raised this way. Sown this way. And he says the seed must die. Now, if you take that analogy, you take a seed and it grows up into something that is very different than the seed. It is certainly very different looking. It is just so far removed from what went into the ground that it is inconceivable in some ways that this seed could turn into this. And yet, if you pick that up and look for the seed's not there separate and apart from this new thing. Right? So it's not that you put that seed into the ground, up grows this plant, and if you dig around in the ground, oh, there's the seed, it's still there. Nor is it even that seed was there and has decayed, and this came totally separate from that. But rather there is that connection. This is what goes into the ground, this is what will come out of the ground, but also changed. And I think that there's an element to that in the resurrection of Jesus. Now, there's some elements that are confusing and difficult to wrap our heads around. Jesus is presented here in this manner, in which his body still has the wounds. I think, you know, when we process that and we think, you know, what about people who have died horrible deaths, you know, closed casket funerals and so forth? Are they going to rise? I think that the wounds are identifying characteristics of Jesus. They continue to be identifying characteristics of Jesus in the book of Revelation. It is the wounds that sort of explain who he is. And so I think that being an important part of who he is, that continues to be a part of his resurrected body. But there's glorification. There is a beauty to what's being described in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I don't know. I'm like John. I'm even less than John. John at least had a picture of Jesus resurrected. I have even less to go on. So there's a lot of questions I can't answer about that. But one thing I am sure of, and I think it's so important, and I'll explain more why it's important, is that the bodies we are living in now, whatever happens to them, will come back out of the ground. And what that will look like and what the result of that will be, I don't know. I just know that that's the truth that Paul is getting at, that the gospel writers are getting at, that the same body that goes in is the body that comes back. It will be a physical resurrection, but it'll be a physical resurrection that is transforming and glorifying and changing because the bodies we live in now, as they currently are, cannot exist in that new existence. So there must be a change. There must be a putting on of something additional or a change to this body. And I believe Jesus went through that process as well. Well, I want to take just a moment then to look through the first element of this point of when the resurrection happened. So keep in mind the what of the resurrection, but when the resurrection, the time and place in which the resurrection occurred is important, especially as we sort of deal with criticisms of the resurrection. It happened in a time and place in which the pagan world believed in an afterlife, but not resurrection. This is one of the difficulties for us because we are preaching the resurrection to a world which increasingly doesn't believe that there's any life after death. But in the first century, the resurrection was being preached to people who did believe in life after death. What they didn't believe, as N.T. Wright would put it, is life after death. Right? So they believed that your soul or your spirit continued to exist after your death, but that nothing else happened after that. And the idea of the resurrection is that, yes, your soul continues to go on, that your spirit lives on past when your body passes away. But then after that, after the afterlife, there's something else. And that is the world that the resurrection came into. So a lot of the arguments about the resurrection are just that second part in the New Testament, because that's the only part that really is at issue. In fact, we'll talk more about this as we get to the Pharisees and Sadducees. I don't believe the Sadducees, in fact, I'm certain of it, they did not deny life after death, the existence of life after death. What they denied was resurrection, which is something different than that. But particularly looking at the pagans, as people look back at the pagans, getting ahead of myself, excuse me. As people look back at the pagans, what they'll say is that this notion of resurrection is just all through history. It's all through various cultures. And basically, there are people who are Jesus mythicists, that is, mythicists. And they would make Jesus into one more myth in a long line of mythologies down through the ages. But the truth is that there's not a single mythology. You may have heard that there is. There's not a single mythology speaking of the death and resurrection of a single deity or even mortal throughout all the mythologies of history. Now, there are some after the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There are none before. Now, people will try to figure out a way in order to say that there was, but in fact, there aren't. As far as the beliefs of the pagans, N.T. Wright divides them into two categories. He says the ancient world was thus divided into those who said that the resurrection couldn't happen, and that would be people who thought like Plato, though they might have wanted it to, and those who said that they didn't want it to happen, knowing that it couldn't anyway. And that would be people who believed sort of what Homer wrote. And so Homer and Plato sort of present these two elements. In Plato, you have people who would like to come back and like to redo things, but there's just no way. And that's the way he presents it. In Homer, you have people who are terrified, like they're where they want to be. Once death happens, that's better to be over in that place, and they wouldn't dare want to come back. And in fact, even the possibility of resurrection is presented more in something like a zombie story. Like if you bring those people back from the dead, it's not going to be a pretty picture. You don't want it, right? So that's the ancient world's idea of resurrection. But as far as the deities, as you look at the cases of deities that people will bring forward and they'll say, here's another resurrection story and here's another resurrection story. And so Jesus is just, he's just a myth that plays off of those earlier resurrections. Jonathan Smith, in his book, Dying and Rising God, says, in the first case, the deities have returned, but they never were really dead. And in the other cases, the gods died and they didn't return. There is no unambiguous instance in the history of religions of a dying and rising deity. Some of the examples that people will give, they'll give Horus or Osiris as an example. They'll give they'll give Adonis as an example, and many, many others. But as you go through them and you begin to pick them apart, you find that the notion that these are resurrection stories, that they bear any resemblance to Christ, just starts to fall apart. So, for instance, in the Horus and Osiris myth, he is torn apart. He is murdered and torn apart. And then the pieces are reassembled by his wife, gathered back together. They're mummified. And so you usually see Osiris presented as a mummy. And then he is raised to rule over the realm of the dead. He didn't come back here. He comes back in that realm that he's already in. She's just trying to put the pieces back together so he can be in one piece over there. Now, some people will say that he was crucified. One writer, D.M. Murdoch, who particularly purports this kind of conspiracy theory, he had to admit when he was asked, now, what do you mean when Osiris was, or Horus was crucified? And he says, well, now look, when it is asserted that Horus or Osiris was crucified, it should be kept in mind that it was not part of the Horus-Osiris myth that the murdered god was held down and nailed to a cross, as we perceive the meaning of crucified to be, based on the drama we believe allegedly took place during Christ's purported passion. Rather, in one myth, Osiris is torn in pieces before being raised from the dead. Again, raised from the dead in the realm of the dead. While Horus is stung by a scorpion prior to his resurrection. However, and Horus's resurrection is also not resurrection, it's actually reincarnation. Not in the same body he dies in. He's reincarnated, in fact, as a pharaoh. But anyway, he says, however, Egyptian deities, including Horus, were depicted in cruciform fashion with arms extended or outstretched as in various images that are comparable to crucifixes. What he's saying is, we found places where the statue is holding his arms out like that. And that's pretty much what Jesus was doing when he was crucified, was holding his arms out. Well, if that's all it takes to be crucified, then Kate Winslet being held up by Leonardo DiCaprio in the iconic image on Titanic is apparently being crucified. You see how foolish that is? You say, here's a God holding his arms out. That's a crucifixion story. You see how desperate these people are to find some way to say that this is just a myth? There's no connection there. But people have taken up that representation and they go around, and I know people, I have friends who believe that Osiris, they've not investigated, they've investigated some atheist with a YouTube channel saying that Osiris was crucified and raised on the third day. And none of it's true. Another myth is Adonis. According to the myth, the infant Adonis is locked in a chest by Aphrodite and given to her sister Persephone, who refuses to return her. Now, Persephone is down in Hades. Zeus settles the dispute by allowing Adonis to spend part of the year in the upper world with Aphrodite and the other part in the underworld with Persephone. In another account, Adonis is killed by a boar and Aphrodite commemorates him with a flower. In the first story, he's just going back and forth between these two sisters as their lover. In the second story, he is killed. And it says, so in the first, he doesn't die. He's just going back and forth. And in the second story, he doesn't rise. But what happens is people combine those and say, here's a story where he died. And here's a story where he goes back and forth between the realm of the dead and the realm of the living. Crucified and raised again. But it's just not true. That's not what's happening there. Now, the notion of dealing with death and the realm of the dead, coming back from the realm of the dead, yes, mythologies deal with that. All that tells us is that people have been trying to figure out how to explain what happens at death for a long time. And they've come up with some pretty creative ways. None of them resemble this. And none of them put death to death like this, which is what we'll talk about more as we go along. So, at the end of the day, everyone believed in an afterlife. Virtually no one believed in a resurrection. Some Jews did. We'll talk about that more this evening. But here is an element of why it's important to understand the distinction between the resurrection, the physical resurrection of Jesus Christ, and just the notion that our soul goes on living after death. The whole world believed that. Christians were saying, no, there's something else. And it's a bigger deal than just that. People today would think just the life after death is a big deal. But people then didn't think that. And so it is greater and a more powerful truth than simply trying to say that there is something else after this physical existence. Kevin, you can take it all the way to the blank slide there. But not show people all my points. There you go. We'll continue looking at those things this evening. Looking at some of the elements that surrounded the resurrection and the time and place in which it happened. And then go on to look at some of those implications that we began to look at in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 as well as some other places this evening. But the resurrection did happen. It's an actual event, and it's an event that demands a response. If the resurrection did happen, then it changes everything. And that's what the Christians were saying, is that you can't go on living like normal when you realize that this has happened, that this occurred in the world. That it is a life-changing event, but it's not life-changing in a personal way. It's life-changing in a worldwide way. It changes life on earth because the implications are so vast. Are you living your life any differently from people who don't recognize the power and the truth of this reality? I hope that as you consider the grand nature of Jesus walking back out of the grave, that you will at the very least consider that there are things that you need to think about. And you have thought about them, but you haven't acted on them. They demand not only a response, but an active response. And if you understand that, and if you understand what it means to be raised with Christ and have not done that, then we invite you to take on that life, that resurrected life, this morning. If there's any way we can help you with that, won't you come while we stand and while we sing?